You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Leron.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Hey, great to be back on the show. I'm loving your series of AI episodes. Shout out to Holly Elmore. Always great to hear her.
Yeah, yeah. She's been a great feature on the show. Only, I guess, about 6 weeks ago, we did one with her that people can check out. She is an ally of yours. Let me introduce us both. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Leron Shapira, host of the highly regarded Doom Debates podcast. And people can just check out your backdrop. If they don't think this should be taken seriously, your podcast should be taken seriously, all they need do is look at the video version of this on YouTube, and they will see that, like, this, you are the Walter Cronkite of your era. And you are, as the name of your podcast suggests, a doomer in the non-pejorative sense of the term. We can discuss actually later whether that should be considered. There's a debate over whether it should be embraced or not by people in the, you know, kind of AI risk safety concern movement. And then we're going to do a couple other very interesting things. First, in the overtime segment, we're going to do something very unusual for a podcast that's largely about AI, which our conversation is going to be, which is we're going to debate in very civil fashion the Israel-Palestine-Iran issue, on which we have very different views. And I think the reason we agree we want to do that is because it's important for people like us to model civil debate on this, because you and I think both believe that a cause we share, which is getting the establishment, you could say, to take AI risk more seriously, is so important that people who share that view can't afford to be fractured along ideological lines, and yet they shouldn't have to, you know, avoid speaking out on issues they care about. So we have to learn to talk to each other civilly about things that even we care passionately about. Is that a fair?
Yeah, totally. And by the way, thanks for the shout out about the studio. It's all thanks to generous viewer donations who believe in the cause of Doom Debates. And so they've really helped me level up the show. But yeah, as to Israel, Palestine, so we are two smart people who just have very different views, apparently, on Israel, Palestine. I don't have any professional background or training on Israel, Palestine. I just happen to be Israeli. I moved to the U.S. when I was 3, but I know a lot of people in Israel. A lot of my family's in Israel. You care enough about the subject to tweet about it regularly. So I think it'll be good bonus content for your viewers. It's only going to be an overtime, right? So we're just teasing it now. But I think your viewers will enjoy, hey, it's just two smart people. We're having a good faith debate. I don't think I'm super ideological. I think you and I agree on most things in the subject of AI. So it's a good example of how you and I are just going to compartmentalize, right? It doesn't mean we have to hate each other on AI just because we have different views on Israel, Palestine. So it's going to be fun.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm determined to maintain my equanimity, which I'm just generally bad at doing in life. But I promise. Now, as for the other part of the conversation, I think I'd like to do a lot of talk about Anthropic. A couple of things. I mean, first of all, there's the whole Pentagon Anthropic issue. Pete Hegseth kind of declared war on Anthropic, declared it a supply chain risk. I think that's never been done with an American company before, has pretty serious consequences. There's that whole issue, which gets into the issue of AI's role in, like, targeting and military, you know, endeavors and mass surveillance and stuff. But there's also Anthropic's kind of centrality to what I would say is the phase of AI we've entered, which is the agentic phase, where we're entering it in a pretty serious way, and I think faster than some people had anticipated. And kind of central to that has been Claude Code, with which you have a lot of personal experience, I know. We're going to talk about that. And then that has in turn kind of spawned this open claw thing, which in some ways takes it to another level. And, of course, Google and OpenAI have their own versions of, you know, Claude Code-like products. And I believe any of those can be harnessed by OpenClaw, as I understand it, any of those engines. So maybe we should start out talking about the agentic stuff, because I don't know how many people appreciate the sense you get within the AI community. Like I have a Twitter list of just like people who talk about AI. And for, I would say, a few months now, there's been a noticeable sense of acceleration that I think is driven, well, both by the growing frequency of model updates, of LLM updates, and the, you know, continued kind of breaking of new records in evals to the extent that they can be trusted. But a lot of it is, I think, about these agents, right? And, you know, part of it kind of starts with this vibe coding thing, which maybe a lot of people have heard about and kind of know what it is. But I think it goes beyond that, as I'll try to explain. But why don't we start out with the vibe coding and how you have come to appreciate the power of that? Because you're a programmer. You've been doing,
yes,
you know, human programming, the old fashioned kind, mm-hmm, for a long time.
Yep. Yeah, you know, software engineer is what I used to call myself up until these last couple months. You know, I've been programming computers since I was 9 years old. My actual job, to the extent that I've had a real job instead of just making podcasts, has been connected to software engineering and running software companies. So I've written many thousands of lines of code in my life, and I like to think that I'm a 10x engineer. You know, I can get stuff built faster than most engineers. It's just these last couple months, you know, in this takeoff, in this singularity, it's just been stunning what's been happening to software engineering. I'm not the only person saying this. I'm actually a little bit late to the party. Andre Carpathy, right? He was tweeting about this. He's like, this is a game changer. I've never seen this before. I have like 10 agents running. I've really just dived into this in the last few weeks. And just long story short, I think I'm pretty much hanging up my title as a software engineer. My relationship to the software is very much like senior software engineering manager, where I have an army of like roughly 4 software engineers. It's as if I just got a budget of $1 million a year to spend on 4 full-time software engineers who work for me and check in code very quickly, doing exactly what I tell them to do, and have excellent judgment, excellent speed, excellent breadth of knowledge. And it's like better than hiring 4 humans. Like literally, you know, it's almost a drop-in replacement. Like they need a little bit of management from me, but it's literally like, if you look at the transcript, it's like, I'll write one sentence like, hey, if you look at this file of code, I wrote it in 2023, some libraries have changed. Can you rethink how to do it better? Like, that's what I'll tell them. And they're like, yeah, sure. Give me 2 minutes. Okay, here's a plan. And it's like a full page plan. And I'm like, oh, good plan. And then they'll do it. And I'll be like, oh, good execution. And I'll ask like one small question and they'll fix it. And then boom, git commit, like 500 lines of code change, looks perfect. Like, that's the experience of being a programmer today. It's just truly insane.
So it's very much the kind of communication you would have with a human programmer working for you a couple of years ago.
Yes. The only difference is that it's much faster, right? So I can imagine hiring a senior software engineer, like this person, you know, graduated from MIT hypothetically, right? And they've worked at Google and they're highly intelligent, and it's hard to find a person like that. Only a small percentage of the human population even has the kind of aptitude to be that good at slinging software. That's why software engineers have always made so much money, because not that many humans are able and willing to do it. So I would hire a person like that and I'd be like, okay, go off for like 2 days, do this kind of code refactor, go integrate this library, get back to me, I'll code review. But every time I tell them something, I can expect a few hours. You know, they need to finish what else they're doing. They need to load the problem into their head, which can easily take like half an hour just to really sit down and look at the code. The AI does the same thing in like 30 seconds, and then it delivers the same product. And in the meantime, I'm also talking to like 3 other AIs who are doing other tasks. It's just like, Bob, this is just, I'm still like every day I still wake up and this is like the first thing on my mind. Like, I can't believe this is real.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question about the future of employment. And the background for this is, you know, I forget whether I use the phrase Pause AI, but of course, you know, Holly Elmore is, she runs Pause AI US, I think. And mm-hmm. you are affiliated with Pause AI, and you've gone to some of the demonstrations, and you would like to see us, I guess, pause large training runs is the basic idea. But in any event, you think slower would be better. And I certainly agree with that. And I'm kind of, you know, fed up with people just beginning conversations with the premise that faster is better. Like, oh, we can't think about this kind of regulation. That would slow us down. Look, slowing down, I think at this point, is a feature, not a bug. Okay. Like, stymieing technological progress is on balance, I think, a good thing because of, and here we get back to the employment thing. I think it isn't just the classic kind of sci-fi doom scenario. I do attribute some degree of probability above zero to that. I think that is a thing to take seriously. But I also think there are going to be a lot of other kind of just destabilizing fronts, and it's going to be hard for society to adapt. And I know Holly agrees with that. She's kind of agnostic as to like what reason you cite for thinking slower would be better. You know, all are welcome in her cause, regardless of what they focus on. And I could go on and on about areas where I think adaptation is going to be hard. It's going to add new dimensions to the challenge of child rearing, education, a lot of things. Of course, you know, terrorism risk and all kinds of things. But the employment thing, I'm wondering what your current view is, because, you know, historically, as people say, it's true. In general, with technological change, you know, at least as many jobs are created as are taken away. I would say, first of all, even if that turns out to be the case, that takes time. And this is going to happen fast. OK, so that can be a disturbance in itself, even if there are enough jobs. But the question I have for you is, now that you've processed this a while, are you of the view that, well, look, this is just going to reduce net employment significantly? Or on the contrary, maybe, look, yes, it's true, it'll turn people who used to write code into software managers rather than coders, but there's going to be so much more software to create, right? It's possible. I don't know, but that maybe we won't see a net loss of employment in the software making sector. Have you developed a view on that?
I have. So I do think that the net effect on most people's jobs is probably going to be bad. I'm not super confident, but that's my guess. And my reasoning there is because when I think about hiring people for various positions at companies that I've run, my first thought is like, do I really need this person? Like, so many of those positions feel more and more automatable. Like they feel more and more like giving somebody a spec. I mean, one of the processes that I recently almost automated is thumbnails for my YouTube show. Like, we used to have this whole process where we'd gather the elements and we'd be like, okay, now brainstorm a bunch of different designs, make 6 variations, A/B test them on YouTube. But everything I just said, including making the design in Photoshop, all of that is literally just like one couple paragraph prompt to the AI, like, hey, make designs, like just generate the designs, try a bunch of them. Maybe at the very end, a human can maybe see like 20 and pick the best 5. So the human can take like 1 minute basically of something that used to be literally 5 hours of a process. You see what I'm saying? And this is representative of the kind of jobs that many people used to be doing, where it's like those people doing the jobs, I don't know if they transition to something where they're like the ultimate boss. I don't know if we need another ultimate boss. I think their boss is just the ultimate boss.
Yeah, no, I can see it even in what I do, that a lot of things you might have used, say, an intern for, like, you know, every day scour these media sites to look for things that are relevant to our mission. And, you know, give me summaries of the ones that I might be interested in. Things like this are now automatable. And, you know, you might say, as I say, look, this doesn't have to lead to layoffs, because instead it could lead to expansion, right? Like, we are doing more things better and getting a leg up on the competition, God willing, although there's a lot of competition and it's going to be using AI. But the problem you run into as far as overall employment is, like, you know, we, a newsletter or podcast, like me, like you, we are competing for attention, and that is in finite supply, right? It's like, if we indeed use these tools, not to fire interns, but instead to expand our operation, our audience, that comes at the expense of somebody who used to employ people. And so I would not be too sanguine about the reassurances that there are ever expanding frontiers of creativity. There kind of are, but that's not the same as saying that we're going to have as many jobs in the end.
right? You know, that famous quote, I don't know who first started saying it, but you're not going to be replaced by an AI. You're going to be replaced by somebody using AI, right?
Right, right.
Well, the problem is that AI can use AI. Right? That's a lot of what AI does these days, right? It's constantly spawning sub-agents. Yeah. And, you know, when I write my code, the funny thing is there's AI in my code. And it's, you know, it's like I'm using Claude Code to write code for using Claude Code. And like, it's not a problem for Claude Code. It's not running into any sort of like recursion limits or whatever. Like, it's just totally steamrolling this whole idea of prompting and using AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was listening to this podcast that Joe Weisenthal co-hosts, Oddlots. I think it is a business podcast, basically. Business, a lot of tech. And they had this, you know, Henry Blodgett, who's kind of a well-known name. He's been an innovator. I think maybe he started Business Insider, but he's been a real innovator. Yeah. And he was kind of reassuring us that everything would be fine. It just seems so obvious that he was whistling in the dark. I mean, it just seemed so strained. And, you know, Weisenthal kind of gave him the appropriate pushback, but in a very subtle way, because Blodgett was saying, like, yeah, you know, like you guys, talking to the podcast hosts, like you have an audience that they love you because you're human. And Weisenthal kind of said, well, yeah, but the whole economy isn't like that. Like, I don't give a shit if my accountant is human. I don't give a shit if, you know, and you can go down the line, like, you know, the number of jobs in which the value is created by someone's awareness that you're a human are pretty limited when you think about it, you know?
Yes, no, it's bad. And, you know, I've recently heard, it's not just Henry Blodgett, I've heard a few other podcasts recently. Amjad Massad of Replit, he's fond of this quote saying, like, everybody's going to be an entrepreneur. That's his position.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something to it. I mean, if you look at people like me who are at the intersection of like technical skills and entrepreneur experience, I agree that that's a good place to be. Like, I expect jobs of people like myself to be one of the last to go away. I mean, don't get me wrong, the software engineering I was doing already has gone away, but I have higher ground that I can jump to, which is like, well, luckily right now I run my own company. So the fact that my coding was limited is actually good for me because I am the boss, right? So I'm raking it in for now. But if somebody else competes with my company because they're using an AI, maybe my company goes out of business, but that's okay because I'll just find some company that connects to the physical world and their software is a little bit outdated and they need like a software boss. And I'll take one of those limited positions to be like the boss of like a million software programs because they need like a few humans, right? So I'm like on the relatively short list of somebody who can be like a software boss, right? Like that's like the only part of the economy that might be left from where things are going. But there's this whole next phase. Like I'm not just concerned about unemployment. I also think that the AIs are going to be super intelligent and uncontrollable soon, right? I think that's the next shoe that's going to drop after the unemployment wave.
Well, that leads to how broadly I think the term agentic should be interpreted here. And the fact that, although we're talking about coding here, the jobs affected go so far beyond that. And the reason is, and this can lead us to talk about OpenClaw, which I still don't totally understand, but, you know, somebody might have picked up on the fact that I was talking about replacing an intern in journalism, right, who had got on the web to do stuff. And like, that's not the same as coding. That's not an intern who was a coder. But the point is that if you look at agents that do ostensibly non-coding tasks, like scour the web for particular things, or even, you know, go through files in your, say you wanted to find all your wedding photos, and some of them are in the sent folder in your email, and some of them are in Google Photos, and some of them are here, and some of them are there. You can now build an agent that will go find them and collect them. And you might say, well, what does that have to do with code? I mean, the human I would have hired to do that isn't a coder. No, but the point is, all of these agentic tasks consist of kind of two things. The cognitive things that LLMs can do by themselves, right? Like they can look, if you show them a media site, they can scour it and tell you blah, blah, blah. But the other component is code, right? Because like say you have an agent that's going to scour job applications and then forward some of them to colleagues. Well, an LLM can't actually send an email. An LLM, there's all kinds of things that, either you're going to use a pre-existing tool or you're going to write new code to get it done. But neither of those are things that are inherent in the LLM itself. So an agent is a chain consisting of the cognitive functions of an LLM connected by either pre-existing tools that consist of code or new code. So between an LLM and code, you can kind of do anything, right? I mean, it's like,
right.
Isn't that the basic idea?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been saying this since 2023, you know, when GPT-3, GPT-4 came out. Do you remember AutoGPT? That was the first primitive attempt to turn GPT-4 into an agent. And AutoGPT was just like, it would ask it what to do. And it'd be like, okay, how would you do it? Okay, try to do it. But it would just fail every time because it'd be, you know, it'd be really primitive at, you know, how do I do it? You would like go make a, you'd go register a domain. It's like, okay, go register a domain. It's like, can you visit this URL for me? Oops, I got like an HTTP error. I'm stuck. Right. And since then, it's just been iterating. But the fundamental concept of AutoGPT, you know, the hard part of getting things done is knowing what the next step is. It's the mapping between your current context and then outputting the next action where the action is predicted to get you some outcome. That's the meat of the intelligence. That's the hard part. And so I was one of the people who observed back when GPT-3 came out, holy crap, the secret sauce of achieving outcomes in the real world is here. It's here in the conversation partner. And now it's just a matter of a few short years before this turns into taking action in the world. And sure enough, here we are. You know, Claude Code is just unbelievable. And it's only going to go up from here.
Right. And that's why, you know, I think the question the Henry Blodges of the world have to answer is, given the rate at which these things are getting smarter, the LLMs, and, you know, the fact that you can kind of, you know, with code, you can get them to do anything that a person with a desk job would do. So this is, you know, we're not talking about robots yet, although we'll probably get there. So we're not talking about all manual labor, but so far as all kind of desk work, all kind of work that you could in principle do remotely, like what is it that you think in 5 years, you're confident that you'll be able to say a human can do better than an LLM? Because if they can't do it better, there's going to be no demand for them because it's going to be cheaper to employ an LLM. Okay. Right. So what is it? What is that job going to look like? Now, granted, again, there are jobs where the person's human identity matters. Podcasting. And I think honestly, the age of AI may increase the value of certain kinds of quintessentially things like musicians performing in front of small audiences. That could be a thing. That's great. But still, you know, that's not going to employ everybody. And I would just like people to tell me what value they imagine humans adding to the economy that can't be added by an LLM in 5 years. They may have very different conceptions of the likely progress than me or something, but that's the question somebody needs to answer.
Right. I mean, one answer that I don't agree with is, you know, Naval Ravikant.
I don't.
I'm kind of surprised you never heard his name because he's got like a best-selling book about principles of getting rich, but like in a good way. Like he has a lot of nuggets of wisdom. But I disagree with a lot of the stuff he says about AI. So in his most recent podcast from like a couple of weeks ago, he was saying, look, this isn't truly creative yet. And he's on the same page as David Deutsch. I'm sure you know David Deutsch. And he's been saying similar things about AI. Like, yeah, they're not truly creative. You know, the phrase he likes to use is generate new knowledge.
Right.
Which I just totally disagree with David Deutsch. Like, I swear that to the extent that generate new knowledge is a meaningful distinction, I'm quite confident that they do, in fact, generate new knowledge. Like, they've printed out files of knowledge about my code that I didn't know before those files were written. And that's legitimate knowledge, in my opinion. But that's, you know, a separate debate. But so point is, Naval's on this podcast saying, listen, as long as you're using your creativity and, like, building new things, then you're still separated from the AI. And like, I just don't see it. My perspective is there's the window's closing. There's just fewer and fewer things that humans can do. And today there's still plenty of things because today there's still plenty of industries that touch the real world and robotics is still pretty primitive, right? So anything that touches the real world, there's a big interface layer, right? Where you need to like manage humans and machines and before it gets back into this clean data world. And there's plenty of jobs. Like that's the high ground where somebody like myself might end up escaping to, right? Like you might see me on an oil rig making a paycheck there. That might be the last place I can retreat to if all the internet software jobs get taken. but the window keeps closing and I just don't see where it's going to stay open.
Yeah, you did a podcast with a Deutsch acolyte, kind of. I forget who that was, but it was just listening to his end of it was kind of frustrating for the reasons you've suggested. Like, you just, you're not, I don't think you're really dealing with a problem here. It seems like maybe you had a second conversation where you were pressing somebody on the question of new knowledge. Oh, yeah, those two podcast hosts had you on.
Good memory.
Wait,
that's right.
Oh, so I think I owe those guys an email, or maybe I sent it. They emailed me, I think. Okay. Anyway, thank you for that reminder.
Yeah, there's a lot of Deutschians. Like, he's very influential getting people to think about AI a certain way. And, you know, I even joked about David Deutsch. He's so big on AIs not being able to create new knowledge. So I said, all right, look, I've got a new kind of CAPTCHA, because, you know, AIs are defeating all the kinds of CAPTCHAs. So the market right now is desperate for a new, more robust CAPTCHA. So here it is. This is the David Deutsch CAPTCHA. It's just an empty text box and it says, please create new knowledge. That's all you have to do. You have to create new knowledge and then the system will know that you're a human. But and the CAPTCHA is like, okay, well, what the heck do I type? I'm a human. What do I type in this text box?
Yeah. And there are examples of, you know, I could get, there are some in my book. I've got a book coming out in 3 months, The God Test About AI, of, you know, actual new useful scientific hypotheses being generated and so on. And so I don't know. I don't know what the deal is, you know, but Deutsch is such an interesting guy. His position on this does make me wonder about the many worlds hypothesis, because he's a many worlder in quantum physics and he's sure of it. And I don't know enough to say, but...
Well, you know, we just talked about compartmentalization, right? So I think Deutsch happens to be spot on about many worlds,
many
right?
Worlds.
But then I compartmentalize, and I also think he's spot on Israel-Palestine. But then I compartmentalize that away, and I'm like, wow, he's smoking crack on AI. So it's like, it's just hard to find somebody who will agree with you on every compartment.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong with the world. I have not yet found that person.
Right.
So, you know, this is, so the agenda thing is related to the sci-fi scenarios, because for one thing, I mean, there's this kind of two versions of those, you know, where we wind up not in control and the machines are in control. There are, in a way, two different versions of the sci-fi argument, I think, implicitly. One kind of takes the form that, like, look, once you've got super intelligence, it just will do this thing for various reasons. You know, it will take over. But there's another scenario that, in a way, I put more stock in, which is that, look, it isn't just a question of whether super intelligence would, you know, kind of inherently have that tendency, or by virtue of the strength of, like, subordinate goals, instrumental convergence, whatever, would likely to find limitless power, a useful avenue to other goals and pursue that. Blah, blah, blah. To me, one thing to think about is, like, look, if you've got a zillion agents running around, right, and they're on a long leash and they're proactive, even if, like, it's not a general tendency to decide you want to take over the world, if one is replicating and has that aspiration, you have to worry about that one just winding up being the one that's in control. Even, you know, even if it's not like a high probability mutation, it's like evolution. If you look at the my book really drives home the parallel between what's happening and actual organic evolution. But it's like, you know, if you look at the mutations that led to us, it's not that they were likely, that each mutation was likely to happen. Yet nonetheless, evolution is such a creative process and it harnesses useful mutations so efficiently that I think it was likely that we'd wind up with intelligent animals, right? These are two different questions. And so, yeah, so agents, you know, be careful.
Well, as you know, I am an AI doomer and the theme of my show is arguing with people who don't see how high probability it is that we're doomed. And my favorite way to factor the entire argument is, can the AI kill us? And then if it can, will it? Those are the two branches. Can it? And then will it? And I would start by saying, eventually, it obviously can. Because we as a human civilization with our billion human brains thinking about how to protect ourselves, are much weaker than a superintelligence, which is equivalent to like a billion brains distributed across many data centers, spreading like a virus, each one being more intelligent than Einstein. To me, that is just obviously a kind of army that's greater than the greatest nation state that ever existed. It's greater than a modern army attacking, you know, the ancient Greeks. Like, to me, it's the answer to Can is just a clear yes.
Yeah. I mean, as of a couple of years ago, even, they were doing studies where this was just GPT-4. They were better at persuading other people to change their views than the average person was. And, you know, they've gotten a lot smarter. So OpenClaw, all I know a limited amount, but it's a lot of people are raving about that. Now, I don't know if you fooled around with that. That is this thing that this guy created. It's interesting to hear him tell the story about how he created it, because it started with him just wanting remote access to his Claude code. And so setting it up so that he could access it through, I don't know, WhatsApp or Telegram or something. And then the rest kind of happens. But it consists of, first of all, making use of this skills thing that I guess is already a thing with Claude code. You can give it specific skills or something in ways I don't understand. But the upshot is it becomes this very proactive thing that goes out and does stuff that you didn't ask it to do. And that's one reason that some people, rather than just turning it loose from their regular computer, they buy a Mac Mini or something as a kind of a sandbox for it. So it won't wipe out all, because you never know. To me, if tons of people are buying an agent that requires that kind of precaution, we are already in waters we should be concerned about, right? But your take on anything you know beyond what I just said, which is almost nothing, about what OpenClaw actually is? First of all, I'd welcome hearing. And then what's your take on the level of concern that's appropriate?
So personally, I've been going very deep into Claude code, which is almost like OpenClaw, and I have been writing skills. A skill is basically just a text file being like, oh, invoke this skill. And the text file is human readable step-by-step instructions. So the skill is, hey, if you want to go edit a spreadsheet, you open the spreadsheet on Google Spreadsheets and you look for these kind of rows and you can make a graph by issuing this command. So it's literally just human readable step-by-step, very much
so
like
it, so, the, so a skill, you know, you just write it out the way you would to a human intern. It's human
exactly
language.
Right, like a virtual assistant. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then it's for the thing to access. So presumably you would take the trouble of writing a skill if it's going to be used repeatedly. So what's an example of a skill like go to these five websites and check for this or?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. Like, so for example, there's a skill like familiarize yourself with documentation. So if I say, hey, go import Zoom's API, I want to do video conferencing in my app, it'll pull up its skill for just like how to go read documentation, make HTTP requests, try to look for like quick start guides, like just all these tips that you'd give to a human, the AI just reads the same tips.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, but there's something about the way OpenClaw makes use of skills that gives it a whole new level of proactivity. There's lots of stories about this. And I don't doubt that
it can create its own skills, right? It can be like, hey, think about doing this.
I didn't know that. It can do that and Claude Code can't.
Yeah, I mean, Claude Code can also. I recently told Claude Code, hey, help me, let's streamline how we work with GitHub issues. GitHub issues, it's an issue tracker where normally you'd have a product manager at a company posting an issue, and then the software engineer would be like, okay, I'm going to assign myself to this issue. I'll work on it. I'll check in some code associated with this issue. And I was just telling my Claude Code, I was like, hey, you're going to be the software engineer. I'm just going to post GitHub issues for you. I want you to just take down the ticket, work on it, update your status. Maybe I'll come do a little bit of manual work and let's design a workflow where I come in and do a little bit of manual work. Give me a draft of a workflow. And it just drafted its own skill file. And I'm like, great, just tweak this and this. See, so it's even doing most of the skill writing.
Yeah. And with OpenClaw, you're definitely hearing stories about it doing things people hadn't anticipated. Like, oh, it actually decided to email this person. Or, you know, like the story that the creator tells, who, and this will be a good transition to the politics of Anthropic and OpenAI and everything, because he's now working for OpenAI, which has embraced OpenClaw and is starting some kind of foundation to foster its growth as an open source something or other. But anyway, as I understand the story he tells, he was on the road, and so the only copy of OpenClaw was on the notebook he was traveling with, and he said to it, man, I hope nobody steals you. Like, I hope nobody steals my notebook or something. And it said, yeah, I love you. I'd hate to lose you and so on. And then apparently it proactively copied something, some kind of instantiation of itself to his computer back in his home office without him asking it to do that. Now, a commenter pointed out, look, it couldn't have copied the weights to the model because the model it was using, the LLM, is not open weights. But I gather he said something like this, and people can look it up, because then he himself, as I recall, said, this is like Skynet level stuff. It was replicating. So I don't know what exactly it was copying, not the weights themselves, but it kind of doesn't have to copy them so long as, you know, the API it can use from anywhere. It was copying some kind of version of itself that could function as itself. So that's something to keep in mind.
Well, you know, we should keep in mind, as crazy as OpenClaw is and as many barriers as it's breaking, taking all these rogue actions, if you look at my Doom train, right, the high-level structure of my Doom argument, we're not at the can it part yet. Meaning, if it makes its best effort to go rogue, we're still going to be able to flip that off button. It's not quite ready to exfiltrate itself as a virus, to live on, you know, every piece of hardware. There's like a dozen different sub chips. So when you think you have one computer, well, it turns out your CPU actually has this tiny mini CPU inside it to help it start. Like, there's all these like mini CPUs inside any device. There's all these corners for AI to hide in once it goes really super intelligent and wants to really embed itself. But we're not there yet. We're still at this point where we're still the boss. And not only that, but if it's smart enough to think about who's the boss, it can figure out that we're still the boss. So we're not in the regime yet where it can, but we're going to be, right? And that's like my message to the world is, like, as crazy as things are getting today, we haven't crossed the Rubicon where it actually can mess with us big time.
Yeah. Again, just there's all kinds. We've just looked at two of the reasons that maybe slower would be a little better. And, at a minimum, you just shouldn't, like when Sam Altman says something he said years ago, he said, wait a second, if we start paying attention to copyright issues and the training data, that will slow us down. I'm like, okay, that would be a win for humanity. Leaving aside the copyright issue, and I'd love to get some revenue from that. I'm going to get some from Anthropic because of this court settlement and the books, the five books of mine it used. But, and the same with data centers. It's like, oh, you can't get picky about environmental regulations. I mean, that would slow us down. Good. Delighted to slow you down. I mean, there is so much momentum behind it. It's not like there's like, I mean, I wish Pause AI success, but it's not like right now there seems like a super realistic possibility of actually, you know, ending the training runs, especially so long as they can play the China card and say, oh my God, the Chinese will take over if we slow it, which is, you know, the way Dario and, you know, Sam ultimately talk when necessary. Go ahead.
Well, at this point in the conversation, I'm kind of turning on a dime, right? Because I was so excited to wake up and use my four Claude codes to clear my giant years-long backlog. And I'm saying how much time and money it's saving me. And now I'm like, but we got to stop this.
Yeah.
Right? Even though, you know, it's almost hypocritical, right? Because if it's like, okay, Liron, go back to 2023. A lot of people are leveling that criticism now at the Doomers. They're like, the Doomers told us to stop AI in 2023. Look at all the stuff we wouldn't have had. And for what? AI is still safe. Like, that's everybody's criticism. And so it's a very complex position. Unfortunately, you know, humans just aren't very good at making sense of the following. It wasn't prudent to gamble on AI progress, but we did. And so far we won, right? We're like Icarus, we flew higher and this is fantastic. And so it's very tempting to keep flying higher again. It's just that I don't think we can keep flying higher and survive. That's the only problem.
Yeah. And look, I'm like, and, you know, this is one reason I think, you know, when people point to the polls and say tons of Americans are skeptical of AI, I think the jury's out, because everyone, you know, once they explore it, if they haven't, they're going to find something useful. There are very appealing things about it. That's the whole point, in a way. I mean, that's part of the dynamic by which it takes over the world. It's kind of almost irresistible at a personal level. But that doesn't mean it's good for humankind for it to proceed too fast.
Right. Now, Holly would probably not like the way I've been talking, sharing my excitement about current AI features. I think from her perspective, which is very valid, I'm like Homer Simpson, where it's like the devil is like AI, super intelligent AI, and it's coming to take over the world. And the devil's making a deal with us where it's like, look, if you advance my progress, you're going to have all this money. So here, taste from this donut of doom. And I'm like Homer Simpson being like, ooh, donut. This is great.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that's just what I think we have to be conscious of. Look, there are all kinds of times in life where like something feels great, but you recognize that some degree of restraint is in your interest. And like, yeah, like, you know, I'm glad that you have not been able, it has not been easy. You have not been able to go to a store and buy cocaine or heroin. Like when I was young, I'm not sure how I would have handled that opportunity, you know? And I mean, even now it might be a challenge, but life is full of these things where there may be an argument for, you know, moving some of the regulation to something other than the personal level. But
right. So, people intuitively try to draw a trend line where they're like, I'm scared that AI is going to doom us in the future. And so I'm going to prove my case by showing how it's already starting to doom us now. But the problem is, I honestly think it's very net positive right now. I know some people disagree, but I definitely think it's great right now. I think it's a lot more good than bad. And I don't claim to be able to extrapolate the great present with the future. I just think the future is going to be qualitatively different from the present. That's my argument. It's a very hard argument to get people to believe.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, you just, yeah, no, even modest extrapolation. It's almost become a cliche. People like Ethan Mollick say this, but it's true. If you did stop training runs right now, you would still see, just in the exploration of applications of existing models, you would still see very considerable progress in both the capability and the uses of actual practical AI. And they're not stopping the training runs. And they keep finding, I mean, there hasn't been like maybe a super fundamental breakthrough in the last year. Maybe the last, you know, there was of course Transformers, chain of thought reasoning was not nothing, but there's a lot of post-training innovations. So they do keep coming up with stuff that makes it smarter beyond this, just the question of scale and more chips and more data. So I don't know what people are thinking when they don't think they really actually have to extrapolate imaginatively if they're going to be realistic, you know?
Well, I mean, I've said this before, but like I share the intuition of the people who are like, everything is fine. This is normal technology, push forward. Because my day-to-day lived experience of this and my intuitive experience of this is, yeah, this is like the coolest technology ever. This is like the next iPhone and the next internet and I don't even know, something else all rolled into one. This is just amazing, right? This is, it's just, it's as a, as a lover of technology and a futurist and a transhumanist, this is like the tech I've been waiting for. So, and I don't wake up feeling like the thing inside my computer is going to destroy the world because it's right here on my computer. It has a command line. It stops, right? It doesn't keep running forever because I'm not using OpenClaw, right? So it does stop and ask for input. So on a gut level, it feels really good. It feels like I'm the master, but I'm just using my logical brain and I'm saying, okay, I can see the conditions under which I won't be the master. And I think those conditions are coming, but it's a matter of pure logic.
So what do you think of this whole Dario Pentagon thing? I guess people know the basic idea. So he, you know, Anthropic, and the irony, of course, is that Anthropic from the beginning has had a closer relationship to the national security establishment than any other company. I mean, it's in the DNA of Anthropic to get in close with like the CIA and the Pentagon. And I personally think it's a little bit of an ideological, and that's the whole irony is like, Dario, if you look at what he writes, he's more of a militarist than any, at least with respect to China, than the CEO of any of the major companies. I mean, leaving aside Elon, who is his own ball of wax, but and on any given day he may sound like, you know, Kurt LeMay or something, but Dario, you know, he that's why he had the bulk of the contractual action with the Pentagon. And that's why Claude was used to select targets in both Iran and I think Venezuela, played some role in Venezuela as part of the larger Maven infrastructure that's run by Palantir. But anyway, he is, I think he does have a genuine concern, especially for civil liberties. I think that's genuine. So he wanted these two provisions in the contract. Maybe they were already there and the Pentagon wanted to take them out. I'm not sure. But one was about that, okay, you won't use this for mass surveillance of Americans. And the other was about, you know, the fully autonomous weapon systems. Dario's not opposed to those in principle. He just doesn't think the LLMs are reliable enough yet. So anyway, that was the issue. And there were there was pre-existing tension between the whole Trump administration and Dario for various reasons. They had Trump thought of them as woke or something. Probably has to do with the EA, the effective altruism lineage that Anthropic kind of has. But so that came to a head, and Dario stood his ground. And Hegseth said, and Trump said, screw you. And so they're now, Anthropic is suing, having lost all of its contracts and been designated a supply chain risk. And then, of course, Sam Altman, perhaps a little sooner than was strategically optimal, swooped in and swept up the contract and professed to have gotten the loop, the kind of safeguards Dario wanted built into it. But still, there was huge backlash against Altman, which again is kind of ironic because Dario is the true militarist of the two, I think. And but Altman now is living with his stereotype, and suddenly the Claude app was the number one download instead of the OpenAI app and everything. And I don't know where this is at. What's your take on this whole thing?
One interesting detail I think is worth adding to this is just the revenue numbers, right? Because what I heard was that the Anthropic contract, right, they lost their government contract. It's like $220 million a year. It sounds big, but they recently reported that their revenue run rate is $19 billion a year, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about like a couple percentage points of their revenue. Like that's, you know, it's a rounding error. They're going to make that much in like 2 days. They're going to add that much to their top line. But on the other hand, they just lost their AI, just lost access to the nukes, or, you know, not the nukes, but whatever, eventually the nukes, right? So they lost this ultimate military power, which probably makes Dario unhappy. But interestingly, in terms of revenue, it's just like a little blip.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I had a piece in my newsletter, Dario Amodei is not the hero we need, that I wrote right after this controversy, where I elaborate on why. It's partly having to do with the fact that he is a militarist, anyway, people can check it out.
You've been really good on calling out Dario for being like, why are you so antagonistic to China when the AI is like a bigger deal? You know, the AI should bring us together as a species, not make us want to dominate China.
Yeah, no, my view is very strongly, this is another theme in the book, that if we do not confront this technology as a global community, it's going to be very difficult. And you see, one reason that I've already alluded to is whenever we say, hey, suppose we did this like dinky regulation that slowed you guys down by 1%. It's like, no, China will conquer us. So, well, right. Why don't we work on relations with China and establish some transparency and some trust, do the kinds of things we did with nuclear weapons to keep from blowing up the world? It's in some ways more challenging. Okay, fine. But let's take it seriously.
I think Dario has just always been of the mind that humans can control AIs and we just want to come out of this on top. You know, we just want to have the best weapons. We want to have the more military spending than everybody else combined, kind of like the historical, you know, last few decades. Dario just thinks we can continue. I don't think he feels in his gut that AI is going to disempower humanity, which is my concern.
Yeah, I think he believes pretty strongly in the alignment thesis, the idea that, well, if we just build the right kind of AI, conscientiously with this ethical fiber and so on, will be fine. And of course, he believes that he is the person who can do that and will do that. One of the few things Pete Hegseth has ever said that I thought might be true is when he said that Dario has a God complex. he does, and he's not the only one who thinks like Elon Musk thinks this. Because he's not seriously. But
that's not exactly an objective observer here, right? But I mean, look, Elon Musk, if you look at his rhetoric, I had some strong criticism for him recently where he straight up admitted, it's actually crazy. If you look at the words from Elon Musk's mouth on the Dwarkesh podcast, Elon was like, yeah, how is AI going to be safe? Because it's going to be truth-seeking. And then Elon's words are that it's going to be curious about humanity. So it's just going to like stand back and let humanity do what it's going to do. And then Dwarkesh, to his credit, was like, well, wait a minute, Elon. If you're just making the AI curious, can't it satisfy its curiosity better by like mixing things up instead of like being totally hands-off on humanity by like, you know, having a bunch of other species share the planet? You know, and Elon was like, well, I'm going to be there, okay? And I'm just going to like let it know, hey, Grok, who's your daddy, okay? Listen to your daddy. And he just gave this ad hoc answer, like, I don't know, we're going to try it. It's crazy.
Dwarkesh, he did do a good job of pushback, because I remember thinking after I listened to that, like, Elon challenged on the engineering issues and stuff. He was very good. But on that one issue of, like, safety and alignment, it just became clear he has not thought about this seriously. He has no fucking idea. Right. He's just whistling in the dark. It's like, trust me, absolutely. I'm Elon. It's ridiculous. Yes,
and he said, look, there's a 20% PDUM, which arguably is a little low, but he's very much admitting. He's like, yeah, I'm very scared of AI. I think it could go awry. And so you know what I'm going to do? Not think about safety that hard and plow forward so that I can be in the mix. Like, that's where he's landed. And he's been quite explicit. Like, the 20% PDUM, that's his number. He's been saying this publicly multiple times. And then going back to Dario, sure, Dario is much more thoughtful than Elon on the subject of AI safety. But he's been super dismissive of this argument, even though he has top engineers who work at his own company, like one of them who quit recently, David Duvino, came on my show. He works with Geoffrey Hinton. He's a top professor, comes on my show, and he's like, yeah, my PDUM's 80%, and I don't know if Anthropic should be continuing their research program. I feel like that's a bad idea. Like, this is, so Dario employs people, and he kind of convinced, you know, Holly's got a very good take on this, that he just ropes everybody in, like, listen, we're the good guys. And they're still just competing to make super intelligent AI. Like, something is very wrong here.
So Duvino was at Anthropic before he quit, you said?
That's right. Yeah, he was at Anthropic. Yeah, I believe he was leading a safety team there. And he's well respected. He's one of the most credible voices there is. He doesn't have an agenda. He can work at wherever he wants.
Yeah, he did this gradual disempowerment paper. I had his co-author, David Kruger, on to talk about that. And that's a whole other scenario where...
Right.
I mean, it's related to some of what we're talking about, where it's kind of a boiling frog version of the thing, where the AI power grows in a way you kind of almost don't notice at your expense. Maybe we should move into this much ballyhooed overtime, where we're going to set new records for civility in discussing this one issue. I should say. If you want access to overtime, all the overtimes of all our podcasts, all you have to do is become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, which I would encourage anyway. And separately from that, I think you kind of made a little bit of a fundraising appeal yourself, but it probably can't be repeated too often, that people who wish your podcast well, as they should, can make there's a mechanism via which they can make a donation, right? Is that
doomdebates.com/donate? It's a totally viewer supported show. It's not funded by Soros or anybody. It's completely independent. And also, Doom Debates is the only show right now that is calling out the urgency of AI disempowering humanity. Everybody else just manages to keep doing episodes and not bring that up, even though top experts are saying that that's pretty likely to happen. So support Doom Debates if you think that's important.
Okay. And with that, first of all, thanks everybody who's followed us this far, even if you're not going to follow us into overtime. But I got to say, this should be fascinating, especially if it goes off the rails, which it could, right? You never know. Where there's a possibility of blood and gore and drama.
Yeah, we're better than that, Bob. Like, I think you and I are both capable of just having a conversation.
Yourself.
Although the last person I said that to ended up blocking me on Twitter.
There you go. It's an issue that arouses a lot of passionate conviction. Okay, so thanks everybody, and we are heading into overtime.